From listener-supported KTOO, welcome to Juno Afternoon, broadcasting live from the homelands of Yaquan and on demand as a podcast. It's Thursday, July 9th, 2026. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. Gunathchish, Hawa, Tuxknussum, Salamat. Thank you for joining the conversation. You may also join us on our live stream on KTOO's YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram pages. Today, we have a look at the Bridge Adult Day Program, a nurturing environment for seniors who can no longer spend the day at home alone. Also, the annual Wander the Wetlands event from Southeast Alaska Land Trust and Discovery Southeast is this Saturday, July 11th. We find out more about this explorative hike. And KTO News Team's 2025 award-winning podcast Outburst is now available on your platform podcast of choice. Today, we take a listen to episode one as we get closer to this year's Glacial Lake Outburst flood season. That's all coming up this hour on Juno Afternoon. Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Tongass Federal Credit Union, a member-owned financial cooperative offering checking and savings accounts, loans, and digital financial services. In Juno at 8585 Old Dairy Road in the K Plaza and at tongassfcu.com, federally insured by NCUA.
Support from Hanson Gress, seeking curious people who like technology, network engineering, and customer support. Opportunities for those who thrive on problem solving. Details at hansengress.com/careers.
You are listening to Community Supported Juno Afternoon on KTOO at 104.3 Juno, 91.7 Juno Ok Bay, and online at ktoo.org. Don't forget, you can also stream us on KTOO's YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram pages. I'm Boston Christopher. Today, the Bridge Adult Care Program provides a safe and nurturing environment for seniors who can no longer spend the day alone safely, are isolated, or experience physical and/or cognitive impairment. To help them make new friends, the program also provides respite for family caregivers along with education and support. And here to share more about that program today from the Bridge Adult Dare K program is Michelle Moore.
Hi.
Hi. Gunathchish for being here. Wasiti, how are you today?
I'm great. Thank you for having me.
Now, are you new at the Bridge Adult Daycare Program?
I am. I've been there since the end of November 2025.
Okay. 2025. Mm-hmm. And where did you come from?
I have been a longtime educator. I taught at Juno Douglas High School for 20 years. And before that, I taught in Texas. So altogether, I was a teacher for 36 years.
Wow.
And I finally retired and was looking for just a second career, something totally different. And I found myself at the Bridge Adult Day Program as their program supervisor. And I now am teaching and playing with elderly, and we have a really good time.
That's amazing. I knew your name looked familiar to me. What did you teach?
Well, I taught drama there and also English, and for 17 of the 20 years I was at JDHS, I also directed all the plays there.
Ah.
But for the last 3 years before I retired, I gave that up and passed that on to someone else.
I see. Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you have a favorite of your plays that you directed there?
Yes. It's when we did Les Mis.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a big undertaking.
It was a very big undertaking. And it was very enjoyable, too.
Wow. That's cool. Yeah. It's such a great stage over there. Mm-hmm. That's so great. So that's a great transition into this new role.
Mm-hmm.
And so what did you find interesting about wanting to work at the Bridge Adult Care Program?
Well, one thing about it is my eldest daughter, Shania Moore, when she was in high school, worked there. Mm. And she worked there in the summers and even during the school year, she was able to go half-time to school and then work there half-time. And she took half a year off of college, still trying to decide where she wanted to go to college, and she continued to work there. And I've known about the bridge for a long time, and it was a really satisfying job for my daughter. And so she asked me to go check it out when I was looking for a second career. And it just fit. It was a beautiful fit. And I love the workers that we have right now. They are amazing individuals. And the clients that we have are amazing. And it's just a really rich time we have together every day.
So this is a day program. So right. What does that mean? Can you explain a little bit about it for those who maybe haven't heard of it?
Yes. So it's open from 7:30 until 5. And so you can schedule your, if you're a caregiver of an elderly person who fits our criteria, you can schedule them in Monday through Friday in between those times and fit your own needs. We have some clients who come every day and are there all day long every day. And then we have other clients that only come 3 days a week or 2 days a week, some only in the mornings, some only in the afternoons. We are fine with you working out your schedule individually for what works for your loved one.
I see. Okay. Mm-hmm. So, and you, because in the intro, I was talking about a little bit, the day program is for those who can no longer maybe be at home alone for whatever reason.
Right,
but
right.
Then you also are providing the support for family members and caregivers,
right.
Giving them a chance to maybe have a break. So
right.
Like you're saying, if they only wanted to be there for a couple hours a day
right.
Or what it might be.
So some of the caregivers we serve through our clients still work, but their loved one lives with them and they need a place to safely and put their loved one and know that they will be engaged all day and still be active. Whereas, you know, maybe some of them could be left at home alone, but they would just sit there and watch TV maybe, which isn't good for elderly people. And we mainly serve people with dementia, some type of dementia or Alzheimer's, or a traumatic brain injury. We have a couple of clients who suffered a stroke. And so we do have some people with some physical ailments. However, our criteria, because the reason why we are called the bridge is because we are a bridge that bridges people into maybe when they get to a place where they have to be monitored and assisted, like in an assisted living.
Like,
we are a bridge to that.
Right.
So our criteria is they need to be 60 years or older. They still need to be able to feed themselves independently, not fix their food. We fix their lunches and their snacks for them, but be able to feed themselves independently, be able to go to the bathroom independently, and be able to move from one place to another independently. Now, that means you can use a walker, you can be in a wheelchair, you can have a cane, but pretty much you can move yourself if needed.
I see. Okay. Yeah, that's a perfect definition of a bridge, right?
Right.
So it's not full-time care, but it's a place to hang out. And like you said, I think one of the big important pieces here is the social interaction, right? Like,
yes.
So what kind of things are the people doing while they're there during the day?
So we do lots of cognitive activities and social activities and physical activities. And we structure those daily throughout the week. And we really plan wisely where we put each type of those activities to fit when they're like cognitive activities. We intermix with social and physical activities, and we plan which of those activities we do based on the time of day when they might be, you know, more awake and active than more, you know, sleepy, and you know how in the mornings you're not ready to do a lot of hard cognitive things.
Yeah.
So we really plan those activities out wisely. And so, you know, some of the things we do, all of it seems like fun. It's all fun, right? We make sure that we're having a good time and we're laughing and we're socializing all day. But some of it's games. We do some dice games and card games, some other types of table games with them. We do physical activities with them, like, you know, cornhole and horseshoe toss, things of that nature. We have many different physical games that we do. And we work on their memory skills, and we have seen our clients really handle dementia issues very well, and it really slows that process of dementia down because we keep the different areas of them, their brain and their bodies, active and working, and we just see some beautiful things from our clients.
And you said this is available when? It's during the day? Is it just Monday through Friday?
Monday through Friday only, from 7:30 in the morning until 5 at night.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So it's a great bridge, like it is called. And this is the only kind of program available here in Juneau?
In Juneau, yes.
Oh, that's
it
so interesting.
It is. Yeah. I know. And it's a wonderful program. And we do accept Medicaid waivers, if anyone's on Medicaid waivers. And we also can accept long-term care insurance. If you have long-term care insurance, we give you the paperwork, and you're the one that has to turn that into that insurance company. But we do help you with that.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, is how much is this, you know, is it affordable? How do you get involved? Do you have to be referred?
No, you don't have to be referred. You can call up and talk to me about it. And at the end, I'll give my phone number and our website. But you can call me and talk to me about it. And here's one other thing I'm really excited about this program. I don't know many programs that have this. If you fit the criteria and you want to try it, we give 3 free visits to make sure that this is something that you and your loved one that you want to sign up for this program, it really works for you. If they're happy, they like it, it's engaging for them, and if it works for us, you know, it's a beautiful way from 3 visits to make sure that this is the right place for you before you spend any money.
You know, it's interesting because, like, you see in TV shows and things like that where it's always like the parent doesn't want to go to a place. They don't want to be put in a home. They don't want to be away from their house. But this is more of just like, hey, I can go do this during the day, hang out with some people, play some games, play some cards, do whatever it is.
Right.
Then I still get to be at home.
Right.
Right. So that transition period into.
Right.
So you don't have the sort of the separation anxiety from being, you know, fully at your home and then
Right. That's right.
And then do you have, in terms of the caregivers, do you also have like support groups for them?
Yes, we do.
Tell me a little bit about that.
Yes, we do. So we offer things that are happening in the community that help educate them. And sometimes we even offer ourselves as doing some educational, like little workshops.
Mm.
And I'm always putting that in a newsletter that goes out every month to our caregivers. If something really awesome comes across, or we're going to offer something really awesome, we also, you know, as the caregivers come to pick up their loved one, we also give them that information right there personally and give them that information. So we have had lots of workshops be offered on dementia and how to help you be a better caregiver of people with dementia type issues.
Mm.
And we've just seen our caregivers grow in beautiful ways. And we're also able to, I personally talk with these caregivers every week. And I'm able to personally give them some of my expertise, depending on what's going on with their loved one. I do that over the phone sometimes even, or through email. But most of the time, personally, just having a little 5 to 10 minute chat when they come to pick up their loved one, if there's something I feel is needed. And, you know, an elderly with these kinds of issues, they're always growing and changing and expanding and things. And so there's always some new things to talk about with caregivers. And it's a great, I just think it's a great way to be more one-on-one with caregivers.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And you and people can get dropped off, or is there pickup options? I guess people could use Capital Access, which
they
I know.
They can. If they qualify for Capital Access, we actually do have a client right now that comes and leaves with Capital Access.
Yeah.
We have another client who she doesn't have dementia. She has some other issues that qualify her for the bridge, and she uses an Uber to come and
leave. Oh, wow.
Yeah. So there's lots of different ways that you might could set this up to get your loved one to the bridge and pick them up. You asked earlier if it was affordable, and I think it's very affordable. We have a sliding scale.
Oh, that's good to know.
That has to do with how much your loved one makes.
Mm.
And everything is based on that. We don't have just this one price fits all.
Okay.
We have a sliding scale of prices, right?
Yeah.
And we talk with you about also what you think you're able to afford. And I know that we have worked some things out with some clients because of extenuating circumstances that you don't see always on a form.
Yeah, for sure. And what's the best way to sort of get involved if you're interested in finding out more, is to call you?
Yes.
So give me your phone number.
Yes.
Stuff.
My office number is 907-463-6171. And again, my name is Michelle Moore. And you can also find information about the bridge on the website ccsak.org.
Yeah, and there's a whole link to that whole section, because Catholic Community Service does a bunch of other things.
Right.
But the Bridge Adult Day Program is one of them.
One.
My last question for you, Michelle, is this. So you taught drama and English
yes.
and students, high school students for 30 years.
Right.
Now you're working with seniors.
Yes.
What are the similarities or differences between those two things? Is there still like, you know, cliques of people, and is there still like troublesome students and things
like that? You know, people are people. And so sometimes the clients get a little frustrated or anxious. We have to deal with a lot of anxiety.
Yeah.
And, I wouldn't call them trouble students, but they do get frustrated sometimes, and because they may not feel like they can always communicate exactly what they want to communicate, or they get very anxious. And so we're really well trained. All the workers there are well trained in how to deal with that, and we do really well. There are no cliques. Everybody at the bridge really enjoys each other, and we have a good time. We don't really have any problems with client to client.
Right.
And I wouldn't even say we have problems there. Our workers get along really well, and I feel like it's a well-oiled machine. There's one other thing I want to mention that's really important. We also need volunteers. So if you're someone out there who is looking for something to do in your community, and you think this might sound like a lot of fun, we have three different types of volunteers. And so if you go onto our website again, ccsak.org, we have a volunteer page. And if you scroll down to the Bridge Volunteers, there's lots of information for you there. And we would love to have you call if you want to be a volunteer and talk to me about that as well.
Awesome. That's so cool.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for coming in today. Gwyneth Cheese, for being here. I really appreciate learning about this.
Thank you so much for letting me come.
And if you have activities or anything else, please come back and let us know.
All right. I will.
Okay.
Thank you,
Michelle. This is Juno Afternoon on KTOO.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. Keeping your home cool in summer can be expensive. One way to help lower your costs is to head to the polls.
Energy affordability is directly connected to policy decisions made by elected officials and public utility regulators. So voting helps communities have a voice in those decisions.
Yadira Sanchez is co-founder of Podare Latinx, a nonprofit that encourages Latino communities to get politically involved. She says many Latinos spend a disproportionate share of their income on electricity, and the burden is growing as energy prices rise and heat waves grow more intense. But she says government officials have the power to help. For example, legislators make decisions about funding for home energy efficiency programs, which can reduce heating and cooling costs. And public utility commissioners, who are appointed by elected officials, or in some states chosen directly by voters, oversee electricity pricing. So Sanchez's group created a bilingual website to help people understand their own energy costs and how government action can affect energy affordability. They're also helping register voters and asking people to pledge to vote in this year's midterms.
We want communities to understand that civic participation is one of the strongest tools we have to create long-term change.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com. Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Emil Mackey at Country Financial, offering insurance for home, auto, and business, and life insurance to protect your family in case of death. Located in the Juno Nugget Mall. More information can be found online or by calling 907-500-7017. This is Juno Afternoon from your listener-supported public media station, KTOO. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. The Southeast Alaska Land Trust and Discovery Southeast are holding their annual Wander the Wetlands guided hike on conservation lands in Juneau. It's this Saturday, July 11th at noon. And I am joined now in the studio by expert naturalists and Discovery Southeast founders, Steve Murley and Richard Karstensen. And I also, they're going to lead the walk and share all of their wisdom, every piece of wisdom that they have about outdoor exploration in Juneau, all in a couple hours on Saturday. And then we also have in the studio with us Matt Robus, who's the board president from Southeast Alaska Land Trust. Gunath Cheesh Wasiti, how are you today, Matt?
I'm fine, Boston. Thanks for having us.
Excellent. Richard, how are you today?
I'm great, Boston.
Excellent. Thank you so much for being here. And Steve, how's it going?
It's going well, Boston. Thank you.
Yeah, we have one mic down today, so Steve and Richard are going to share, which is good because you have to take turns practicing talking, not at the same time, right? So that's good. Let me start with you, Matt. Tell me a little bit about the Land Trust and sort of working with Discovery Southeast to have this Wander the Wetlands event.
Well, the Land Trust, one of our major activities is conserving valuable pieces of habitat in Southeast Alaska. Most of it is pretty close around Juneau. And we'd like to help people understand the values that we're conserving on those lands. And this type of walk and other events that we do, such as bird walks with Juneau Audubon and so on, are designed to just bring people out on our lands and see what those lands hold and what they support. And so the Wander in the Wetlands this year, again, is going to be in our Montana Creek parcel. And that is of interest not only because it's got very good habitat, especially for small passerine birds, but also various mammals and other critters. But it also performs potentially a flood mitigation function. And in this town right now, that's really important to understand. And that's one of the things that wetlands can do, is to kind of mediate flooding. And between the CBJ lands and this piece of land on the west bank of the Mendenhall River, it could play somewhat of a of a role in softening the flood a little bit this year and in future years.
So I know that the wetlands is a giant piece of land, right? I'm just showing the map for those who might be on the stream from the state game refuge or from the State Department. And that it's a big, it's like, what is it, 4,000 acres, the whole wetlands that we're talking about? That's a big piece.
The whole Mendenhall wetlands?
Yeah, the whole Mendenhall wetlands.
I'll defer to Richard. He knows the acreages.
Yeah, I can't see your map, but you may be referring to the Mendenhall tidal wetlands. And what Matt is referring to is a freshwater wetland that's up in the west side of the valley across from the area that's been flooded.
Oh, so it's totally different. Oh, so we're talking about two different wetlands. So we have multiple wetlands. This is good for me to know. I didn't know this.
They're also quite extensive, not as much so as the tidal wetlands, but there's a lot of acres back there of land that's you could think of as a sponge that's waiting to absorb a little bit of this flood that we're anticipating having again.
I see. Okay, I think maybe, Matt, I got confused with when you work with the Audubon, you go on the tidelands,
yeah,
right?
That's correct. Yeah, usually okay. That's out on the Mendenhall wetlands.
Okay, so this is a different piece that you all have ownership of, basically, in
correct.
The land trust.
It's south of Montana Creek Road between kind of River Road on the east, the Mendenhall River Valley and or channel and Montana Creek on the west.
I see. Okay, so Richard, how big is this parcel that the land trust has? Do you know?
I'd have to look at a map, but it's in the tens of acres.
Yeah, okay.
Probably 100 acres.
I think it's 127 acres.
Okay. 127, okay.
Yeah.
The records, the official records.
Wow, so, you got that on the top of your head?
He's got notes.
I've got a paper here.
So, Richard, you're talking a little bit about how this can sort of be a mitigation for the flooding. Can you talk a little bit about that?
It's at least very connected with the river. There are models that people can see when they go on the flood portal that – you can bump up the projected flooding level from 15 to 16 to 17 to 18 feet. And if watch what happens on the west side of the river, not the developed part, but watch what happens when you go from 17 to 18 feet. Suddenly that whole surface is projected to be flooded.
Oh, wow.
So in a very severe flood, it would be underwater as well. And one thing we'd like to do on Saturday is, if you think about the HESCOs and all the riprap that's been put in along the river, the flood barriers, we'll be on the undeveloped side looking across at that for a lot of the walk. And we'll be able to think about, okay, how do these things affect each other? How does building a barrier on one side of the river affect the level of flooding on the other side?
Interesting. Okay. And Steve, grab the mic. You guys have been doing this walk for a couple years, number of years? How many years has this been?
Yeah, we've done it five times.
Okay. Yeah, five times. And what can people expect? Who should come to this walk, I guess, is what I'm trying to figure out.
That's a great question.
Yeah.
Anybody can do this walk. It'll be variable between being on the trail that runs through that section, and in some ways we like to go off trail and have the experience of what that land really looks like and feels like.
Okay. So and like if I'm coming on the walk, what am I anticipating to learn, I guess? What am I going to learn about?
Well, I think that's the walk itself. Which is what I've been doing with kids for a long time, is just to have the physical experience of navigating that country.
Right.
Whether you take in particular aspects or concepts of that place, your body's still walking through it and getting a feel for what it's like to be there.
Yeah. Yeah. And I know Discovery Southeast, you all work throughout the year taking folks out, kids out to different places, right?
Yeah,
and just
mainly
sort of have,
kids.
Getting them to have the experience of being outdoors on the land,
right?
And doing these sorts of things. So this could be for families or for, you know, anybody, right? This is for anybody who wants. This is public,
right?
Yeah, and you don't have to. Do you have to register, or do I just show up?
Oh. We'd like people to register just so we have an idea of how many people are coming, but it's not like we have a hard limit or anything, and we would like to encourage more people to think about coming out.
Yeah.
You can go to, is it Discovery Southeast or?
The Land Trust is doing the registration.
Okay, so the Land Trust is on our website, would be doing the registration.
So that's cialt.org, I believe, right?
Right.
Yeah. Or you can just Google or put in your favorite search engine, Southeast Alaska Land Trust. You'll find their website, and you can see where you might be able to register for this. I'm sure there's something on Facebook, too, right? Something, probably an event on there. So I'm curious, Steve, when you were co-founders of Discovery Southeast, what brought you to wanting to bring this to the fore, Discovery Southeast?
You want to try?
You want to try?
I'll do it.
Okay.
Well, we were both guides with Alaska Discovery a long time ago.
Yeah.
And one of the things that started to creep into our awareness is that we're taking tourists out to Glacier Bay or out into icy straits and all that stuff. But there was some pull to come back in and do some activities or learning for folks that we live with and take it out of the tourist thing.
Yeah.
And it turned out that Richard was out in the Boy Scout camp for a long time, and there were teachers from Harborview who'd go out there and spend a whole week with a classroom. And Richard sort of started to notice that, and he was becoming himself his own kind of naturalist and began to share with that group of teachers.
And the
following year or so, I think that's right, they invited him into a classroom, and that's kind of like gave us this opportunity to go, wow, we could do this with younger kids and of all ages. Right now, Discovery Southeast is with preschool kids all the way to eighth grade.
Yeah, okay.
We're in every school.
That's great.
And we are... our purpose is to get kids exploring the landscape around them. Most of them are in wooded areas and such, right?
Right.
So that's kind of how we got going.
Richard, tell me a little bit about the light bulb moment for you and with this experience that Steve was telling us.
Yeah, I think it was 1988. I was working with half of the teachers at Harborview, the ones that were pretty hardcore, already getting their kids outside a lot, including these overnights that Steve mentioned. And the other teachers got jealous. They saw they were having so much fun, they wanted in on it.
Yeah.
So we started applying for grants, and our first director, Scott Berlinski, who's now over in Sitka, he managed to get us funding, and we did a full year with Harborview. That was what launched it. And then the other schools started getting jealous, and we started expanding out into the rest of the district.
And this was, you said 1988?
Yeah, it was way back.
So... You'll all be coming up on 40, is it 40 years soon?
Yep.
Wow, a couple years. That's amazing.
I just met, I think, the first grandchild of a former nature studies student.
That's what I was going to say. You're probably starting to see the generations.
We've had many board members who were nature studies kids, and now we're going into the grandchild generation.
Oh, that's amazing. That's really cool. Yeah.
I goofed up before. In order to register, you need to go to a website that's called tinyurl.com/wander2026. The 2026 is numerals. Or you can call the Land Trust at 586-3100, and we will register you.
Okay. I like a tiny URL because that's nice. So tinyurl.com/wander2026.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, that's really cool. That's great to know. Or just call the Land Trust at the main line and you can get on the list.
Right.
And so how long is this going to be on Saturday? It's noon, right? And so I register and then I show up. And then how long are we going to be?
4 hours.
4 hours?
Yeah.
Oh, we got to bring snacks,
yep.
Right? We should probably bring a backpack
idea.
With some water.
Water.
Some snacks.
Gear.
What kind of rain gear?
Rain gear.
I was going to say, what kind of footwear should I be?
This could be a wet hike, so red rubber boots are recommended.
Okay. Yeah. Wow. And will I see wildlife on this?
We'll certainly see. We can promise you sign, and we can promise you bird song, but
what wildlife is going to privilege us with a view we cannot guarantee.
Right. There are no guarantees ever, right?
That's the thing about wildlife. Yeah.
There's no guarantees ever. And Matt, because this people may or may not understand about the Southeast Alaska Land Trust, I know that some people just talk a little bit about like people can give their land to the land trust too, right? And can't you like donate your land if you have some land or a big, does it need to be a big part? Because you guys have like, how many pieces do you manage now?
Oh boy.
It's a big number.
It's over 20, maybe 26, something like
that. Yeah, I remember it was a lot. Yeah, high 20s, something like that. Yeah.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
Some pieces of land are more appropriate for us to manage than others. So, you know, some lands that are offered to us, we work out some sort of a donation deal or a purchase deal for the purpose of conserving the land as habitat and to perform all these ecological functions. Other pieces are better suited for raising funds as opposed to actually serving as a piece of
a steward.
Conservation.
Yeah, okay, right.
And so people are welcome and invited to contact the land trust if they're interested in doing something with a piece of land that they own. We don't accept everything that's given to us for just the reasons of capability. We have a very small staff a lot of work to do. So, yes, if people are interested, we'd like to talk to them, but not all lands are really they don't fit into our portfolio necessarily. We have to be a bit choosy.
Right.
So I can't just say, yes, we'll take anything.
Right. But you might be able to direct somebody or they could, you know, they could find out some information anyway.
Yes, yeah. All sorts of different arrangements can be made. So
yeah.
It's better to talk about it and figure it out than to not even try.
Yeah, absolutely. And Richard, I want to go back to one piece. We were talking about, you know, we're looking at the GLOF here and couple of weeks, maybe. They said it might, I had some folks on earlier. They said it might be earlier than it was last year. Mm-hmm. And you were all mentioning that this land has some way of being a part of that. Or tell me a little bit more, unpack that for me a little bit.
We should be thinking about marginal lands. I mean, we're also focused on what's happening to residential parts of the valley, rightly so. But even if that were your only motivation, it's important to understand what's happening. Like along the lakeshore, when the waters come up, it floods a vast area out near the visitor center that's also acting as a sponge.
Mm.
And this piece that the Land Trust manages and CBJ lands on the undeveloped side of the river are part of the dynamic of a glacial outburst. The constriction of the river by the barriers we're building is going to change that.
Oh, okay. How's it going to change that?
Well, imagine a pinching a hose. You're going to increase the force coming out of that hose.
Oh, the pressure, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, it's like, and are you all, is Discovery Southeast or the Land Trust, are you all in the conversations with those folks who are managing the GLOF and everything? Like, do they reach out and say, hey, what can we learn? I mean, I know you guys have experience in terms of your areas of expertise.
Yeah. I am through another group that we haven't mentioned, the Southeast Alaska Watershed Coalition.
Right.
So we're talking today about the Land Trust, SEALT, but SAWC, the Southeast Alaska Watershed Coalition, is contracting with us at Discovery to sort of bridge between disciplines. They've hired a lot of top-notch experts, hydrologists, geomorphologists, to weigh in on mostly the habitat aspects of these events we're experiencing. And what I'm trying to do for them is give an overview, like what was this like 200 years ago? What are the trends? How are the landforms going to be different 20 or 50 years from now? Questions like that. Contextual stuff. I'm not an expert in any aspect of river flooding, but I can help experts talk to each other.
That's the important piece, is to get everybody talking about what's going on here. And also to get out and see what these lands are all about. And this is what we're talking about today, is the Wander the Wetlands, the fifth year of doing this out there. at the piece. Sign up at tinyurl.com/wander2026. Give the phone number again, too, for me, Matt, if you would.
It's 907-586-3100.
Great. And you can go out on Saturday. It's July 11th, this Saturday at noon. And you can allow Steve and Richard to fill your mind with all things of wonder.
Why you wander.
Why you wander. Get filled with wonder. I think that's fantastic.
I really, those two go together really well.
They do. They do. Because, I mean, part of the reason of taking a walk is to let your mind, you know, commune with nature and be out there. And you never know what kind of thoughts can come to you. You can get some brilliant ideas when you're out there wandering the land, for sure.
And deeper understanding.
Yeah, deeper understanding. That's excellent. And so take your family, get out there on Saturday, July 11th at noon. I really appreciate Steve, Richard, and Matt being here today. Gunath Cheesh, have a great time on Saturday.
Gunath Cheesh.
Thank you. Gunath Cheesh. This is Juno Afternoon on KTOO. This is Juno Afternoon from your listener-supported public media station, KTOO. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. Speaking of the Glacier Lake outburst flood season, last year, KTO News produced a podcast called Outburst. It won first place with the Alaska Press Club for Best Narrative Audio Program, and it placed nationally in second place at the National Public Media Journalists Association Award for a narrative-produced program. So Outburst is a fantastic program. You can now get it on all of the services, wherever you download your podcasts, you can get Outburst. Today we're going to listen to episode one of the Outburst podcast, which deals with, you know, the idea that hundreds of people in Juneau's Mendenhall Valley are living on the front line of a climate change disaster that they necessarily didn't see coming. It's been a few years now. We're learning a lot more. This podcast is the story of how glacier outburst flooding has escalated faster than the human imagination and public policies to protect people. The KTO newsroom and reporter Alex Solomon take you from the floodwaters to the glacier's edge to uncover why the annual flood happens, how they got control, and what can be done to keep Juneau safe. Here's episode one of Outburst.
It's past midnight on August 6, 2024. Many people living near the Mendenhall River wake to the sounds of rushing water, snapping tree trunks, and an eerie cold in the air. At 1:20 a.m., water started spilling in through the back door of the Laurie family's home. Minutes later, the floodwater broke down the door and rushed into the bottom floor. It floated the piano, a dresser, and the bed where the eldest daughter, pregnant at the time, had been asleep minutes before. She, her two teenage siblings, and their dad waded through freezing water rising on the street and drove to stay in an emergency shelter down the road. But Diane, the mom of the family, stayed behind because she was worried about her dogs and guinea pigs and her elderly neighbors whose house was dark.
And so I'm sitting in the dark and I'm just hearing things banging and breaking.
Almost a year later, remembering that sleepless night brings her to tears.
And I think about things I need to do to prepare, but you can't. You can't prepare for the trauma.
Hundreds of people in Juneau's Mendenhall Valley are living on the front line of a climate change disaster they didn't see coming. From KTOO Public Media, this is Outburst, the story of how a freezing cold disaster has escalated faster than human imagination and public policies to protect people. I'm your host, Alex Solomon, climate and environment reporter at KTOO in Juneau. This is Episode 1, The Flood Zone. The Mendenhall River started flooding more than a decade ago, but for a while, it was treated as more of a curiosity than a cause for concern. Then, in 2023, everything changed when a record-breaking 15-foot flood hit the valley. A couple of dozen homes flooded.
Stunning images there goes. To say the least. Unbelievable to watch an entire home crumbling there.
One empty house collapsed into the river. It got national TV news coverage.
That is just one example of the severe flooding that is devastating parts of Juneau. But this is no ordinary flood, by the way. This is climate change on full display.
A condo building dangled precariously over the torrent. The state of Alaska issued a declaration of disaster emergency. But still, when water breached the river's banks the following year, almost to the day, many residents were taken by surprise. The 2024 flood broke the record again, this time cresting at 16 feet, and it was catastrophic. Nearly 300 homes flooded. The federal government declared it a major disaster. But why were so many people stunned? And why wasn't Alaska's capital city prepared? To understand how a disaster that's been ramping up for years could shock people, we have to examine human psychology and how that plays into policy. And we have to understand the science. Let's start there. Unlike most floods, the ones afflicting the Mendenhall Valley are caused by glacial lake outbursts, or jökulhlaups, an Icelandic word meaning glacier burst or run. And they're a consequence of climate change. At Thunder Mountain Middle School, a group of students sits by a large picture window overlooking the river, where contractors are building a flood barrier. Water lapped up on campus in 2024, but stopped just short of flooding the building. This spring, students in an earth science class studied the danger.
The root problem is, well, it's the Suicide Basin, which is between the Mendenhall Glacier. It's like a little area where water can build up.
That's Vivian Esmail, who was in eighth grade last school year. She didn't know what a glacial outburst flood was before taking the class, even though she lived through them. But now she does. She describes how ice used to fill Suicide Basin, but now the glaciers have melted back and revealed it. Rain and meltwater collect there during the spring and summer. Water pressure builds up against the glacier, which acts like an ice dam, the only thing holding the water back. Once the pressure becomes too much, billions of gallons of water start boring a hole beneath the ice, which grows into a tunnel and can float the glacier.
At once, it like can burst through like an entire large amount of water. That's how these floodings are happening and why they're happening yearly.
Researchers got their first alert about the potential danger of a glacial outburst flood in 2011 after a relatively small release. They took a helicopter over the glacier, identified Suicide Basin as the source, and started monitoring it with a remote video camera. Then, after the first major flood in 2023, when the basin fully emptied, the researchers measured how much water it could hold. But because the glacier is constantly changing, so is the basin. And there's another challenge. The size of the flood also depends on how fast the water rushes out. So the National Weather Service publishes an initial forecast of how big the flood will be using the flow rate from the previous year. Here's what National Weather Service meteorologist Grant Smith posted in a Facebook video a couple days before the 2024 flood.
The forecast of the 15 feet is based on the worst case scenario where the entire basin releases.
But forecasters can't tell how fast the basin is emptying until it's already happening. Aaron Jacobs is a senior hydrologist at the National Weather Service in Juneau and part of the flood forecast team.
After we get some data we can analyze, we will update that forecast on the fly.
He says it takes about a day's worth of data to see how quickly the water is actually moving. And that process is partly why so many people living in the valley had their guard down. The forecast was updated from 15 feet to nearly 16 feet just 12 hours before the flood hit its peak. And not everyone knew to check the forecast again. Before then, nobody knew how likely a flood of this magnitude was, or that it would hit hundreds of homes. Now we know that the 1 foot difference at the lake level translates to a more than 25% increase in water volume coursing through the river. And then there's the human element.
It's really different when it comes into your own life.
That's Elizabeth Figgis. She lives with her partner and cat on View Drive, a dead-end street that looks like a peninsula, jutting out into the river. Some of the properties on her street have flooded over and over again. When the flood struck in 2023, she and her partner were on a boat off the coast of Sitka. Her neighbor sent them photos of their trucks immersed in water.
It was just shock, I think, really. And I study climate change.
In general, people tend not to think that climate disasters will affect them personally, even if they believe climate change is happening. Figgis is a researcher who works in the region to document and find ways to adapt to climate change.
And flooding that isn't climate change based, in my experience, is all history based. So any fastidious home purchaser looks at the entire history of the property that's on record.
When her partner bought the house, they looked at FEMA's flood inundation maps and saw that it wasn't in a high-risk zone. In fact, most homes that were inundated in last year's glacial outburst flood didn't appear in areas of concern on FEMA's hazard maps. The ones that did were in what's called 500 or 100-year flood zones. That means, according to FEMA, they could have expected up to a 1% chance of flooding in any given year. 1%. That's because those maps were based on historical data. And at the time they were made, the highest flood recorded on the Mendenhall River was just 12 feet. Now, after record-breaking floods 2 years in a row, we know that even more damaging ones are possible. We're in new territory with a threat that has quickly evolved. The past is no longer informing the future. City Manager Katie Kester says residents received notice of the impending flood in 2024.
We had a lot of people be like, but you didn't tell me that this was going to happen. And we did. They just didn't believe that it was going to happen.
Those in the area got an evacuation warning via text and email. Media outlets posted warnings and stories well in advance. The city also blocked off some roads expected to flood and coordinated an emergency shelter for people to stay at. But even still, Kester says she didn't expect the danger to escalate from what the Valley had experienced the previous year.
I think it definitely caught the community by surprise.
After the 2023 disaster, the city expedited the permitting process for homeowners to harden the riverbanks using large boulders. But without public willpower directing the city government to be more proactive ahead of 2024, Kester said the Juneau Assembly didn't feel pressured to do more to prepare.
You know, while you can say, oh, we should have hardened the bank before 2023, it just wouldn't have been possible. There wouldn't have been the political will. There wouldn't have been the financial will. There wouldn't have been the opportunity to do those things.
Mayor Beth Weldon says the Assembly did try to take action after 2023, but the flood was small enough that the city couldn't get support to help the community.
Yes, it was very dramatic, but it only affected 20 people, and we just weren't getting the state response and the federal response. We did try the same things, but we weren't getting any response.
Since the 2024 disaster, the Valley community has pushed for action. There have been multiple meetings led by residents whose homes flooded, the city, and the Tlingit and Haida Tribal Council. This year, the city put up a temporary levee made of steel cages filled with sand. The levee should protect most residents from floods at heights they've seen in the past, and likely ones quite a bit larger. But some streets were left without a flood barrier. And many residents say they need a long-term solution to feel safe in their neighborhoods. Each year, as the basin fills up, the clock is ticking down for scientists who are trying to answer one major question. How big can the floods get? In the next episode, we'll take you to the glacier's edge, where researchers are looking for answers in Suicide Basin.
Right there, another calving space. Yeah.
Any engineered solution is going to need to know how big could Suicide Basin get. And its current size, double its current size, triple its current size. We need to know how much water we'll be dealing with.
In Juneau, I'm Alex Solomon, climate and environment reporter at KTOO. This series was the brainchild of Anna Canny and was funded by the Alaska Center for Excellence in Journalism. KTOO city government reporter Clarice Larson and I wrote this episode. Claire Strempel, Adeline Baxter, and Lisa Fu edited it. Dave Waldron is the audio engineer. The theme music is by James Crawford and Vance Westlake.
And you can catch the entire series of Outburst on your podcast catcher of choice. That's going to do it for today's Juno Afternoon. We are Wednesday through Friday at 3 p.m. right here on KTOO Juno 104.3 and KAUK Juno Auk Bay 91.7. You can find the show online at kto.org/JunoAfternoon. You can find live stream archives on KTOO's YouTube page. Our theme music is by Indian Agent. Programming support for Juno Afternoon comes from Tongass Federal Credit Union, Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, Hanson Grass, and Country Financial. Juno Afternoon is a project of the KTOO Arts and Culture team. I'm Boston Christopher, producer and host of the program, with help today from Aaron Tripp. Gwyneth Cheesh, have a fantastic Thursday. We're going to go out today with a little Yahtzeen song from their new album, Stand on My Shoulders. Have a good evening, everyone.